We come then to the question presented. Does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does. We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. Therefore, we hold that the plaintiffs are, by reason of the segregation complained of, deprived of the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. That's the ruling of Chief Justice Earl Warren in the famous Brown versus the Board of Education case of 1954, one of many decisions attempting to address the issue of equal educational opportunity in America. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What led up to the Brown versus the Board of Education ruling, and what tactics were used to avoid implementing it with all deliberate speed? How have states' rights and federal policy collided over the question of how to educate our children? And how have issues involving bilingual education and special education played into the movement toward equality in the classroom? Joining us to explore the history of equal educational opportunity in America is Adam Nelson, Professor of Educational Policy Studies and History at the UW-Madison, and the author of The Elusive Ideal, Equal Educational Opportunity and the Federal Role in Boston's Public Schools 1950 to 1985, published by the University of Chicago Press.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
When I heard that name, Earl Warren, I was reminded of billboards that sprouted up across the South and seemed to stay there for many years. Impeach Earl Warren. Implying that there was a considerable disagreement with that 1954 decision about separate not being equal. But it also makes me wonder, if we go back to the beginning, to the founding of the Republic, was there any sense of a standard, of a national standard for schools as there would have been for various other things that would unite the country?
That's a really, really good question. And it's that issue of standards, as it might relate to equality, that was at the heart of the Brown decision and did go all the way back to the beginnings of the Republic. Of course, the founders believed that education was necessary in a democratic society, or a republican society, as they would have called it. It was necessary to teach the values of self-government. It was necessary to teach the skills to be successful in a competitive economy, a market economy, one that was going to soon become more and more industrialized. They recognized that education was important. But was there a standard for education? The answer to that question is basically no. When it came to the early republic, there were all kinds of different schools that students could attend. We had no public school system as we would know it today. Students could attend charity schools funded by churches. They could attend so-called dame schools, which were basically babysitting services in the homes of benevolent women. They could attend subscription schools where people would pay a little bit to send their children to school, and they would get whatever that tutor had to offer. They could attend, if they were living in rural areas, so-called moving schools, where a teacher would literally go from place to place, boarding with the people in town, and provide an education for a set period of time.
Oh, Ichabod Crane was one of those.
There we go. Exactly. And of course, eventually there were academies, private academies, that also received some public funds. So there was no standard. Students could attend all kinds of different schools. When I talk to my students, I refer to this as the hodgepodge of educational opportunity in this period.
What did Thomas Jefferson think of that?
Thomas Jefferson, it's an excellent question. He, of course, was a major spokesperson for the importance of education in the early republic. And he proposed a bill during the Revolution in 1779 in Virginia to more or less standardize or provide some system of education in the state of Virginia. And it was sort of a complex system that involved picking the best students, providing equal education to all at the lowest level, and then moving the best students through to the College of William and Mary. And the legislature voted it down. And he was deeply disappointed.
What's the thinking of the legislature?
The thinking of the legislature cuts to the core of another American value in education, which is the value of localism, the value of local control over schools. and the idea that different citizens and communities should be able to provide the education they want locally for their children. And they saw Thomas Jefferson's proposal as the first step toward dangerous centralism.
Was there a sense, and we're talking about Virginia in this case, is there a sense that the interests of Virginia educators would be different from the interests of Pennsylvania or New York educators?
Another very good question. Of course, historians of this period and the colonial period in American history are interested in these regional variations. And there was quite a bit of regional variation. So if we compare Virginia to a place like Massachusetts, which famously had an early movement in the colonial period toward town schools, we see a difference. And one of the things that Thomas Jefferson was doing in Virginia was picking up on what he thought were some lessons learned from the history of education in Massachusetts, having to do with how to fund schools. Now, Thomas Jefferson's proposal involved certain forms of tax to support schools. Early on in the colonial period, Massachusetts thought they could use land sales to fund schools.
State land sales?
State land sales. Basically, it's they weren't states, so this is colonial land.
To individuals.
Right.
Sort of like the early origins of property tax?
Early origins of property tax, but this is land held collectively by the colony or ultimately the state.
So they're not talking about bond issues at this point.
No, exactly. And what they found is that in a period of abundant land, the price they could get for that land was very low, not enough to support the schools. So Massachusetts then moved to a tax system. And what they found then, this is in the middle of the 17th century, was that a number of communities were suspiciously unmotivated to pay school tax. And instead, as soon as the fine for failing to pay the tax was lower than the tax itself, they paid the fine.
That seems to be a little miscalculation on somebody's part. And the idea was that you would pay this tax regardless of whether you had children or not.
Exactly. And this issue of paying for the education of other people's children is an enduring debate in the history of American education, because a lot of people wondered how much is education a public good and how much is it a private good.
I assume that at this point we're talking the education of boys, that we're not remembering the ladies, as Abigail Adams suggested, that it's educating boys and educating boys from white families.
Basically, that's right. It's going a little too far to say that we're only talking about boys, because there were girls who gained access to, you know, basic literacy and numeracy and had other forms of education, because education isn't only about literacy and numeracy. It's about values. It's about other skills that may be employable. And when it comes to non-whites, it's an interesting question because, of course, the early colonists made efforts to educate Native Americans in their ways. And there were efforts that involved basically free schools for free blacks in the North. So we can't exclude these groups completely, but the emphasis is definitely on the education of white boys.
And did that system in Massachusetts prevail? And then with a different, so still a different system in Virginia?
It does prevail, this system of trying to tax towns. Towns taxed themselves for education, and the colonial legislature and then early state legislatures insisted that localities continue that tradition, more or less. But we still have this, what I call a hodgepodge of different kinds of schools all the way up through the 1820s and into the 1830s when we get the Common School movement, led famously by Horace Mann in Massachusetts, Henry Barnard in Connecticut, and others who want to address the question of quality and inequality in school offerings in a state like Massachusetts or Connecticut.
Now, you've mentioned towns, but at this point, America is still close to 90% rural. So how would you begin to fund and work out the logistics for rural schools?
That's an excellent question. It's one of the reasons that Horace Mann gets involved in thinking about rural areas as they become more and more populated in the industrial period and towns start to coalesce more. So what he's interested in is how towns can be more or less districted so that they form enough of a – this is rural
areas. A school
areas,
district.
A mm-hmm. school district that can take more or less collective responsibility for funding its schools, and that the state will incentivize that kind of activity through promises of help, sometimes financial help.
Even now, you know, what gets taught is highly controversial. You know, what do you teach evolution in the South? Do you do this? Do you do that? Back in mm-hmm. the early times leading up to the beginning of common schools in the 1820s, 1830s, what kind of debates over curriculum take place, you know, in what our children are taught?
So that's an excellent question because, as always in the history of American education, there are intense debates about what schools should teach. There's basic agreement on fundamental skills in literacy and numeracy. That doesn't really create much debate. What creates debate are sort of the values lessons that schools are expected to convey and promulgate. And there's agreement that schools should teach values. There's disagreement about what those values should be. So when it comes to the Common School movement, we often talk about how that movement was addressing increasing immigration and how immigrants could be assimilated into American society and culture through the schools. But that movement, that attempt to assimilate immigrants, raised a lot of questions, for example, around religion. The Common School movements, Horace Mann, Henry Barnard, and so on, they were more or less overtly Protestant in the set of values they wanted to bring to schools. They weren't sort of the puritanical Protestants that Horace Mann in particular had had a bad experience with in his own school, in his own childhood. He was more of sort of an evangelical, benevolent, caring, gentle Protestant, not that sort of fire and brimstone experience that he'd had as a child. So he thought the schools would be welcoming on sort of when it came to moral education. But as more and more Catholic immigrants arrived in the United States from Ireland in the 1840s, Germany and Central Europe in the 1840s, the question of religion in schools became fraught.
Well, what kind of religion was being taught or implied in the schools up to that point that would be in conflict with Catholic values?
A lot of it came down to the choice of which Bible to read. So it wasn't so much that people disagreed on what religious core Christian values might be. It was how you got to those values, how you taught those values through literacy. And since Bible reading was a regular part of the school curriculum, which Bible mattered? And, of course, the Catholics had their Douay Bible, especially after the middle of the 19th century, and the Protestants were using the King James Bible. And probably subtle differences in interpretation and translation between those texts were lost on children, but they mattered to the adults who controlled the schools. And so there were huge debates. And eventually you get the creation of parochial schools, a lot of interest in the Catholic community in the United States to create a separate parallel system of schools.
That would be paid for privately?
By parishes.
What about the issue of language instruction as you have more immigrants coming in?
So this is another really good question. And I think now people are sometimes surprised to hear that public schools in the middle of the 19th century were not necessarily conducted in English. You could have publicly funded, sometimes state-supported and state-supervised schools operating in a variety of languages. They might be operating in German. They might be operating in Norwegian or Swedish or Finnish. And the local community was able to make a decision for itself about which language the schools would use. As assimilationist pressures become more intense in the late 19th century, that language issue becomes a subject of controversy. There's an increasing Americanization movement as the numbers of immigrants grow, and there's fear of sort of the loss of a core American culture, and pressure on schools to teach in English grows.
With the Civil War and the split between North and South and all the tension that brought, what kinds of effects do you see on the school system, which is just starting to kind of figure out what it's going to do, right?
Absolutely. So, of course, the Civil War is a cataclysm in all kinds of ways in American culture and in American institutions. And the schools get wrapped up in that debate. So some of the most interesting work on the effects of the Civil War and the Reconstruction period after have to do with the creation of schools throughout the South, because the South had lagged in the creation of common schools. A general Southern aversion to centralized authority, property tax strategies were unpopular, largely in the South. There were big debates between wealthy whites and poor whites about supporting schools. And finally, after the Civil War, you have sort of a breakthrough as the new Reconstruction state constitutions are required to include schooling as part of the rights of citizens in the Southern states. And along with those new state constitutions come the federal Reconstruction amendments having to do with citizenship and equal protection. And the federal government then gets involved in ensuring access to education for freed peoples in the South. And you have lots of debates about whether those schools will be integrated or segregated, how well funded they will be, whether that funding will be equal to the school. Of course, the schools end up segregated.
What about the schools in the North and Reconstruction? I mean, is there a debate about whether they would be integrated?
There was, and there was a debate about that even before the Civil War. My colleague Hillary Moss at Amherst College has written a new, relatively new book on debates about race and citizenship in schools in the North and also border states.
And what kind of education are we talking about here? We're talking about through what we would say eighth grade now. What sort of schools were these?
Again, excellent question. Basically, yes, through eighth grade, but maybe only even fifth or sixth grade. You have the earliest high schools all the way back into the 1820s, but they don't grow as an American institution until really the very late 19th century. And it surprises some people to know that you don't get half of the high school age cohort attending high school until the middle of the 20th century. So we're mostly talking about education through early adolescence.
What would it be typically, an 8 or 9 month school year?
Sometimes. Again, it depended on whether you were living in a rural area or an urban area. Increasingly in urban areas, you get, you know, a standard eight-month, nine-month school year. But in rural areas, of course, school took place in the winter, the fall and winter. And then when it was planting season in the spring, students would go back to the fields. All the way until the sort of beginning of the 20th century, that would happen in rural areas.
And I gather there wasn't a provision in those rural areas for transportation. You were pretty much on your own.
You were on your own.
A lot of miles of walking.
Long walks through knee-deep snow that we hear about.
One of our recent PhD students, Pat Stovey, has done a really great dissertation on rural schools in Wisconsin, and she has a whole section on mud.
And mud and slush, probably.
Were these been mostly one-room schoolhouses, the classic one-room schoolhouse, or were they bigger and more complicated than that in the cities?
Oh, in the cities, definitely. By the late 19th century, we have sort of competition among cities to create more elaborate school buildings that are symbols of the city's prosperity and its commitment to education and so on. In rural areas, yes, many of them are one-room school houses, sometimes divided into rooms by hanging sheets and so on. Share the heat.
Do you have sort of new concepts of how to educate children with the, you know, kind of taking ideas from Rousseau or the German notion of kindergarten and sort of more hands-on, more field trips, more natural approaches to education?
Yeah, well, what you've done in that question is link sort of the origins of some progressive ideas about education, especially early childhood education, to sort of progressive era innovations in education in the late 19th and early 20th century. So people, yes, they looked back to Rousseau. They looked back to a Swiss philosopher named Johann Pestalozzi and his student Friedrich Froebel. And from them, they got the ideas of kindergartens, which sort of take off as a movement in America.
That's those Germans again.
The Germans had a huge influence on American education and, of course, certainly here in Wisconsin. By the time you get to the progressive era in the late 19th and early 20th century, you have a lot of interest in educating the early childhood, promoting creativity, not just sort of the lockstep sort of rote memorization and recitation approach, but instead hands-on activities, as you've suggested. And that becomes really a critique of the traditional common school, as progressive educators like John Dewey say, we need to create a new American citizen who is inclined toward critical thought, who is capable of questioning authority, and so on. That's the democratic citizen he has in mind. Progressive education is a tough sell in a lot of American communities where basic skills remain a very, very high priority.
We're going to talk about the argument over basic skills versus cultural education between Du Bois and Booker T. Washington when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Adam Nelson, and we are talking about the history of equal educational opportunity in America. And we've come to sort of late 19th century America, early 20th century. Two key figures seem to be Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, both wrote about African-Americans in this country. What did they have to say about schooling, and why did it become such a big debate between them?
This is a famous debate, and it's so important when looking at the sweep of sort of the history of American education and some of the core issues that remain with us today. So Booker T. Washington had come from slavery. He was born into slavery and then attended the Hampton Institute in Virginia. And from Hampton, with the help of Hampton's founder, he becomes the leader of the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And his program, which he had learned at Hampton, was about industrial education and basic literary education for really the freed people of the South, the impoverished black population of the South, teaching marketable skills. Industrial education, manual education. And it's important to remember that the ideas of manual education were not limited to the black population in this period. There were lots of sort of worker education programs that had gone back for white workers to the early 19th century to cultivate a work ethic. So it's not unique to African-American education in this period. But Booker T. Washington got a lot of white philanthropic support for his mission. And a lot of that support came because he was willing to accommodate Jim Crow principles in the South.
So he was considered a moderate.
He's considered a moderate. Some people consider him a gradualist, and others sort of more critically would call him an accommodationist.
What did he mean when he said something about put down your bucket wherever you are?
Put down your bucket wherever you are. So he gave a famous speech at the Atlanta Exposition in which he was sort of the first black leader to address such a large white audience from a position of some authority on the question of black education. And he said that essentially blacks needed in the South needed to start where they were and not try to skip steps to a place that he thought they were not yet. And by that, he meant they needed to cooperate with whites. He also talks about the relationships between blacks and whites in the South as being as separate as the fingers, but as united as the hand. So he accepts this separate spheres for blacks and whites approach. And he essentially sees the black population economically as simultaneously self-sufficient. He wants them to be self-reliant. That's a key theme of his. But also in service to an economy that is largely dominated by whites. And so he's trying to work out a relationship at a time of very difficult, often violent relations between whites and blacks. And it's important to be aware of the degree of hostility that blacks faced if they pushed hard toward a more integrated or even interracial society. Lynchings were not uncommon in this period.
Yes, for much after that period, too.
So it's important to consider his context.
And it was actually controversial in some places in the South just to have Booker T. Washington addressing an audience of white women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He himself was, in a sense, taking a risk. And he chooses his words very carefully. And it's sometimes interesting to think, even from a literary perspective, how he constructs the meaning of words in a way that will sort of reach out to his audience's understanding in a way that requires some double reading sometimes when you're reading what Booker T. Washington wrote and what he said. Of course, his counterpart, in a sense, on the other side of the issue is W.E.B. Du Bois, who's a younger generation.
And he had a lot to say about double consciousness.
And he had a lot to say about double consciousness.
Different background.
Very different background. So, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois is born in Massachusetts. He grows up in Great Barrington, has a relatively peaceful childhood, goes off to Fisk University in Nashville, succeeds there, then goes on to Harvard, where he ultimately earns a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, and then he goes to get a PhD in Germany. And while he's in Germany, the German Empire is beginning to establish its colonies in Africa. And he starts to see the cause of racial justice as really a transnational or international movement already in the 1890s. And he comes back to the United States and, as a scholar, is at the University of Pennsylvania, and he does studies of segregated communities in Philadelphia. And he then writes really a classic and canonical tome on Reconstruction. And he looks back at the efforts to create schools in the South for African Americans. And he notes the extraordinary commitment of freed blacks to education. And in a way, he echoes a sort of a famous line from Booker T. Washington's autobiography called Up From Slavery, when Washington said it was like a whole generation going to school. And when Du Bois is studying that period, he notes the same thing. But then, sort of a generation after those early years after the Civil War, around the year 1900, they have different opinions about what will benefit blacks in the South when it came to education. And they saw this confluence of sort of education, political rights, and economic opportunity. And they saw the mix of variables differently. Booker T. Washington emphasized establishing an economic foundation first. Du Bois said an economic foundation alone will not ensure black civil rights. And we also have to have political rights.
How would you establish this? He's talking about blacks establishing an economic foundation, or what would be the way of accomplishing it?
For Du Bois?
Yes.
So for Du Bois, he's from a younger generation. He has not grown up in slavery. He has a bit more aggressive tone and some militancy even in this period. That might be taking a little bit too far. He ultimately is quite strategic in the way he makes institutional decisions. But when it comes to what comes first for Du Bois? Is it an economic opportunity? Is it political rights? Is it a form of literary education, especially for a leadership class? For Du Bois, it's really not possible to separate, I think, which one comes first. They're all interrelated. They must come simultaneously. And you're asking sort of who's leading this movement? Who is going to be the vanguard of black opportunity in America? And Du Bois has the famous idea of the talented tenth. Mm-hmm. And it's also very important to know with Du Bois that his emphasis on literary education applies to all blacks, but it applies especially to this leadership class who need an education that is equivalent to the education of the white leadership class.
So is Du Bois mostly sort of objecting to Booker T. Washington accepting sort of education in the trades, practical education, and Du Bois is claiming the best education, the cream of the crop education for this talented 10th.
For this talented 10th. W.E.B. Du Bois does not object to the idea of sort of industrial education for marketable skills for large numbers of African Americans in the South and throughout the United States. But he thinks that Washington has not put sufficient emphasis on that excellent education, literary education for
kind of a
leaders.
European model, isn't it? I mean, in that it's, I think still in a lot of European countries, the student takes an exam at a certain age to determine if he or she will go into what would be called trade schools versus university in that liberal arts sense.
Yeah. Well, actually, this raises a whole set of ideas that are important in this period that are sort of surrounding Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois as they're having this debate, which has to do with hierarchy and stratification in the overall system of American education.
And the word class is not too far behind then.
They're in classes not too far behind. And as I alluded to earlier, you have a proliferation of high schools in this period, as new layers of education start to emerge and people stratify themselves based on, as you were just suggesting, sometimes their test scores, their performance on college entrance exams, and so on. So there's this expansion of the system of American education and a stratification of that system at the same time. And those phenomena have a lot to do with how Americans saw citizenship and democracy, equal opportunity, in the school system. To what extent would schools provide the same education for all, and to what extent would they provide different education based on ability or other social characteristics?
It starts to sound like those good old accelerated courses.
Yeah. Well, indeed, in this period, you have the invention of sort of tracks in schools. And in 1890, there was a famous report that suggested that all students should share some common experience in schools, but after that, they might pursue different routes. And then in 1917, in a report called The Cardinal Principles, that is reaffirmed, that students may pursue different tracks as they move through the school system.
But the idea has always been that American schools would be schools in the sense of up through eighth grade or even through high school would always be free, no tuition.
The idea was, yes, that at this point, the idea of free schools, tax-supported schools available and open to all, was well-established, absolutely well-established. But when it came to stratified education like high schools, people wondered if not everyone was going to high school.
Right.
And in this period, it's a small minority who are going to high schools. Should the public fund those? And there was a big debate about that.
What did Booker T. Washington and Du Bois think about segregation? In other words, were they just arguing for access to education, certain kinds of education, regardless of whether it was segregated or integrated?
That's a really good question. In the Progressive Era, and we're talking about the Progressive Era with the sort of core period of their debate, segregation was institutionalized in the South. It was a de facto phenomenon throughout much of the North, and it was legalized in the federal government. And so neither one of them is pushing for some sort of immediate dismantling of segregated institutions. The question is how hard they're pushing for racial cooperation, an interracialism in American society. And Du Bois is one of the founders of the NAACP, which is going to use and build a strategy around using the courts. And this becomes important in the Brown versus Board of Education case, led by the NAACP's famous and wonderful lawyer, Thurgood Marshall, who becomes the Supreme Court Justice. The NAACP, which Du Bois had founded, is going to use the courts to push for anti-discrimination decisions, including decisions that question segregation. Interestingly, in the 1930s, W.E.B. Du Bois faces some criticism from his fellow members of the NAACP for saying that maybe at a time of economic cataclysm, at a time of desperate need for work, possibly, and he echoes Washington on this point, the black community should put jobs first, even if they are in a segregated black economy, and not necessarily push aggressively for integration. This is at a time, this is during the Depression, when FDR is being asked about supporting anti-discrimination legislation, anti-lynching legislation. And since FDR's political coalition relies on Southern Democrats, just as it relies on Northern Democrat working-class vote, both of those constituencies are not enthusiastic about ending segregation, FDR pulls back from those kinds of initiatives. And so we see Du Bois sort of aligning with that gradual take it slow approach to a very, very sensitive issue.
Did the Roosevelt administration, as they did with so many things, want to make progress, I'll call it progress, in terms of like uniform standards for schools throughout the country?
So
integrated or otherwise, I mean.
This is leading in a very interesting direction because the question of the federal government's role in schools was very controversial. What role should the federal government play in an institution that is traditionally a state and local responsibility? In the 1930s and before, you see the federal government taking baby steps to promote certain kinds of programs in schools. Let's say aviation education. And schools might accept grants for that kind of program. The federal government might, during World War II, they actually, and in the late years of the Depression, think about school lunches as a way to help with commodity prices, but also provide nutrition in schools, which has an equity component to it. But the federal government, before World War II, is very reluctant to get involved in schools.
No funding? No federal funding?
Very limited federal funding, except in the case of federal property, so military installations and so on, in which case the federal government takes responsibility for schooling on those.
And how did, as long as you've mentioned the military, if we get up to 1948 or so when Truman desegregates the military, mm-hmm. does that apply to military schools?
Yes. Insofar as the military is desegregated, it's desegregated after 1947. But interestingly and significantly, if we want to talk about Brown versus Board of Education and its legacy, the year after the desegregation of the military in 1947, in 1948, Thurgood Marshall and his team at the NAACP bring a suit to court about integrating education. It has to do with a teacher education student in Oklahoma named George McLaurin. And he had gone back to school at the end of his life, but he wanted to go to the PhD program in education at the University of Oklahoma, which accepted him, but insisted that he spend all of his time basically in segregated spaces. So literally, while he was listening to lectures, he had to sit in an anteroom by himself and listen in on the lecture.
You kind of wonder what their thinking was in admitting him in the first place under such circumstances.
There had already been some case law suggesting that Southern states had to provide truly equal education even if it was segregated. So this is the NAACP's strategy was to push for equality, hoping that eventually that would lead to integration. So University of Oklahoma is trying to comply with those earlier decisions. Not only did he have to sit in a separate room while listening to lectures, while he ate lunch, he had to go and sit in a separate area of the cafeteria at a separate time.
Oh,
so not only was he in a separate space, but he was alone in that separate space where the whole cafeteria was empty.
And would that have been backed up by Plessy versus Ferguson? Is that where this is sort of separate as long as it's the same lunch or the same cafeteria?
That's right. So Plessy versus Ferguson had codified in law the principle of separate but equal, basically Jim Crow segregation. And states were allowed to segregate as long as, theoretically, they provided equal opportunity. And the NAACP's strategy was to bring a series of cases that questioned whether those separate facilities were, in fact, equal. And it's fairly obvious, and it was to the court in McLaurin's case, that they were not. And they found in his favor. They found in his favor. And that decision in his case, the suit had been brought in 1948, came down in 1950. Along with another lawsuit, 8 months later, Thurgood Marshall and his partners filed the papers for Brown versus Board of Education.
And we're going to talk about that famous case when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Adam Nelson, and we're looking at the history of equal opportunity in schools in America. And a landmark case was Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, which we usually think of as just desegregating schools, but these things are never quite that simple, are they?
Never quite that simple. Of course, it wasn't until a year later in 1955 that the court issued its Brown 2 decision, which said that schools must be desegregated, quote, with all deliberate speed, as Emily quoted in our opening. And of course, the Southern states organized to emphasize the word deliberate, meaning slow. So The sequence of events is familiar to many people. That's a decision in 1955. In 1956, over 100 members of Congress assigned a Southern Manifesto to resist desegregation. In 1957 is the famous standoff in Little Rock, Arkansas, where Governor Orville Faubus had tried to prevent desegregation, and then President Eisenhower federalized the National Guard to allow those black students to enter Central High School, only to see Governor Faubus the next year see him close those schools. And that then initiates a number of years of different strategies that the Southern states used to resist desegregation, including closing public schools completely so that people who wanted to send their kids to school had to create private alternatives, or pursuing token integration, where maybe one or two African-American students would be admitted to a formerly all-white school and the district would call itself desegregated, or school choice plans, wherein the option to attend a white school was theoretically available, but the bureaucratic hoops were so numerous.
Well, back to the old kind of poll tax technique.
Mm-hmm. That virtually no schools were desegregated. And it wasn't until the mid-1960s that the Supreme Court really steps in again and says, speed it up. There's a decision, the Griffin decision in 1964, and perhaps even more importantly, the Green decision in Virginia in 1968, say that essentially schools must be desegregated root and branch right now.
And that's mm-hmm. regardless of where the students are in a community. In other words, this is where busing comes in.
Interestingly, busing is almost implied in the Green decision, but it comes up a little later, and I'll explain how that happened. In the Green decision, the Supreme Court said that schools had to show that they were actually desegregated. They had to show that the enrollment was racially balanced in proportion to the community's racial composition, suggesting that somehow you had to achieve that racial balance in the different schools. But it wasn't really until 3 years later, in 1971, in the so-called Swan decision, which was in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, North Carolina, the Supreme Court renders a decision which allows the district to employ buses to move the students around to achieve racial balance. So that moment opens up a series of controversies about whether student assignment was going to be colorblind or now color conscious.
Yeah, the other extreme.
And right. It also suggests that perhaps attending a racially balanced school is a higher priority than attending a school closest to your home, which is, of course, why Linda Brown brought her case in the first place. And so sort of a decade and a half after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the issue of desegregation had become more complex because it was, in fact, being implemented finally. And it raised a lot of controversies in communities across America. And 2 years after that Swan decision, in 1973, you have the first Supreme Court decision about desegregating a northern school district. It's the Keyes decision about Denver. And interestingly, that case involves three-way desegregation: black students, white students, and Hispanic students. And the question is how to accommodate the needs of all of these students in the schools that they end up in.
Well, and that brings up the issue of bilingual education again, which had been there back when immigrants were coming and so on. How has the debate over bilingual education kind of been a parallel story to the issue of race?
Another really, really great question. The stories go together in so many ways because they are about a public school system in a democratic society that claims to promote equality of educational opportunity. That said, as we saw earlier in this hour, communities across America had taken an interest in running public schools using their own language, languages other than English. And then over time, of course, the history of America is the history of immigration in a lot of ways.
And assimilation.
The pressures to conduct classrooms in English grew. After World War II, and especially after Castro's revolution in Cuba and increasing migration of Spanish-speaking immigrants into American schools and especially into northern school districts, you get a big debate about language in schools. And in 1968, the same year that the Supreme Court said we need to start really acting on desegregation, the federal government passed the Bilingual Education Act, which was actually a component of the earlier Elementary and Secondary Education Act to provide funds for disadvantaged, targeted at disadvantaged students. And those funds were supposed to facilitate programs for English language learners. Now, interestingly, many of the programs that were created were ESL programs designed largely to facilitate a rapid transition to English, not teaching in another language, although that was part of the
just a transitional process,
transitional
procedure.
Programs. Mm-hmm. The question that arose in the Keyes decision then was how to preserve the integrity of those programs designed for specific groups of students while also promoting racial balance at the school level and, some would have argued, ideally even at the classroom level. So there was a tension about how to preserve curricular programs, the students who were taking advantage of them often being from one ethnic group, and also promoting a level of integration. And you see a lot of struggles within schools about how to place students while also complying with desegregation orders and at the same time attracting what had now become federal offers of money,
right,
grants and aid, for programs that often required students, a certain number of students, who spoke the same language to be together in the same classroom. So in order to be effective and reach out efficiently to those students.
And that starts to sound a little bit more like separate but equal again.
And those debates circulated widely. They caused a lot of anxiety and animosity in different school districts across the country. And the racial politics of that period, the late 60s into the early 1970s, sort of played into and fed some of those controversies. And it was a very difficult time in public schools.
What about the case that took place involving special education and a student with a disability, I think Down syndrome or something like that, being placed in a bilingual classroom?
Mm-hmm. So,
sort of the, you know, lumping all the sort of others together.
Yes. And this was happening really across America because, you know, in earlier periods, there had been a great deal of effort to make public schools places where everyone could get the same education. And lo and behold, they succeeded in a lot of ways, but all students are not the same. And so then the question was, what about these other students, some of whom speak other languages, some of whom have various disabilities, physical, cognitive, and otherwise? And schools had not been doing a good job of accommodating these students. So in the same period that we're just talking about, the early 1970s, you have a series of important Supreme Court and district court consent orders and decisions and so on that require the public schools to accommodate these students and provide a free and appropriate education for them.
And this is regardless of federal funds, this is in principle.
This is in principle. This is a matter of civil rights. And incidentally, the arguments can get a little complex, but these decisions are based on the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause.
Right.
Just as Brown versus Board of Education had been. And so there's an imperative to avoid racial segregation when treating groups of students who are racially identifiable. And so insofar as schools had been placing students with special needs disproportionately in isolated classes when they were racial minorities, the idea was that that practice should stop.
Because it was racially imbalanced?
Because it was racially imbalanced.
That's sort of a catch-22, isn't it?
It's a catch-22 in many cases because the idea is to provide appropriate education, that it is also in the quote-unquote least restrictive environment, which means the most integrated environment. So there's always a tension around race, ability and disability, and placement when it comes to meeting needs and unique needs in many cases, while also facilitating the most integrated school experience for all. This causes contortions in school districts as they want to meet their principled obligations and commitment to civil rights, while also meeting the needs of students and, let's be honest, attracting grants for special programs, which don't necessarily track onto isolated programs.
And then there's the whole issue of testing, too, of course.
And there's the whole issue of testing. So this is a long story in itself, but we've talked in this hour about how the idea of standards and assessing the effectiveness of schools has been something, a point of interest among many Americans and governments, levels of government. And after the period we've been talking about, which is really sort of the legacy of Johnson's Great Society programs, his war on poverty and all of the sort of new social welfare programs designed to advance that cause. By the late 1970s and into the early 1980s, people were asking, is it working? Are schools, in fact, providing equal opportunity that we can see?
How do you measure it?
In achievement. And by the late 1970s and early 1980s, you have an accountability movement increasingly emphasizing standards and testing to determine whether our money as taxpayers is well spent.
And then the next extension of that logic, as one president said, is you teach to the test, right? Let the test be your determination of what your curriculum is going to be.
Often this seems to have been the case. And there is, as you can certainly imagine, a great deal of discussion in the professional education community and in school districts across America about the degree to which schools may be teaching to the test. And the catch-22, as you suggested earlier, between wanting schools to allow for individuality and creativity, but also wanting to know if schools are working and whether they are working for all. And those two ideals are, you know, quite naturally in tension with each other. The question is how well we hold them in balance. And some would argue that I think today the balance may have shifted in one direction and we may be needing a little bit of a shift back in the other.
Let that pendulum swing.
In just the few seconds we have left, final thoughts as you look at education today in America with your historical knowledge. What do you see around us that we can sort of blame history on for the messes we are in today?
Well, there are always messes, but there's also some inspiration, I think, to take from the past. I mean, we've seen concerted efforts really on both sides of the dilemmas we've talked about today. On the one hand, there has been a lot of effort to promote equal opportunity for groups that have been excluded from schools. And that movement tends to emphasize standards and really equal treatment and sameness. On the other hand, we've had really inspiring efforts to remind the schools and ourselves, our communities, that all students are not the same, that students are different, that students have unique and individual talents and gifts, and that our public school system, for the good of our democracy and, many would argue, for the good of our economy, need to do both. They need to provide equal opportunity and they need to recognize talent and individual gifts. So I think if the schools can hold those things in balance in a way that the public can support, then the public schools have a future.
An ongoing balancing act as situations change daily. Our guest has been Adam Nelson. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.